Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm heading out on the road this March, so join me in Albuquerque doing a live show with Charlie from Crime Lines, Nina from Already Gone, Lainey from True Crime Cases, and Eric from True Consequences on March 5th at Rico Bravo Brewing Company. For tickets and more details, go to truecrimebullshit.com and click events. I'll also be doing meetups in Las Vegas on March 7th at Atomic Liquors, LA on March 8th at the Bigfoot Lodge in Atwater Village, and San Francisco on March 12th at Churchill. Again, for more details and times, go to truecrimebullshit.com and click events. And remember to join me and the researchers Thursday after the show at 9 p.m. Eastern on YouTube for a live stream discussion about the episode. For more information, go to truecrimebullshit.com and click video.
This is True Crime Bullshit. I'm your host, Josh Hallmark, and this is a serialized story of Israel Keyes.
The Deborah Feldman case files are upsetting. The Hackensack Police Department files consist of just 18 pages. 11 of which are possible matches for unidentified remains that came from the National Crime Information Center, and the subtext therein, that more than half the case files are the investigators just fielding unidentified remains, is particularly grim. In terms of an active investigation, there are merely 5 pages. And more precisely, just 10 paragraphs devoted to the life and disappearance of Deborah Feldman. NJ.com, an online news site local to New Jersey, covered Deborah's disappearance in December of 2013, after she'd been linked to Israel Keyes. That article is 33 paragraphs. And even that, the most sympathetic and holistic article or report that seems to exist, uses descriptors for Deborah like drug-addled and farming herself out for cash as a prostitute. A local website devoted more time and energy to Deborah's case 4 years later than the actual investigators did at the time of her disappearance. And that's after a serial killer became part of her story. Here's what we know about Deborah Feldman. Deborah was born on September 8th of 1960. We don't know where nor what her maiden name was. In the late 80s, she married, and in 1989, she and her husband had their first and only child, a son. At some point between the birth of her son and 2003, Deborah and her husband became estranged, and it's unclear when or what the impetus was, but it was during this period that Deborah allegedly began using drugs. According to the NJ.com article, a son's torment, believing a serial killer strangled his mother, in 2013, Deborah's estranged husband was awarded custody of their son. In that same article, her son discusses Deborah's years of drug use, in particular, heroin and cocaine, and her continual threats of suicide. The article does its best to paint the picture of a troubled woman and the trauma inflicted on those around her. But it fails to get to the crux of who Deborah was, and how she became the troubled woman they write about, opting instead to devote multiple paragraphs to the life of Israel Keyes. Deborah becomes an afterthought in the story of her life and death. Very little else is known about Deborah. In 2019, I briefly chatted with her son to get more information, but a full conversation never materialized, and I never heard from him again. The Hackensack Files do provide a little more insight into Deborah's life at the time of her disappearance. Deborah had a pet cat, who was taken to the Bergen County Animal Shelter 5 days after she disappeared. Deborah was reported missing by her nephew at 9:30 a.m. on April 10th. He told investigators that he'd last heard from her during a phone call at about 10 a.m. on April 8th. And while this would seem to indicate that she was fairly close with this nephew, it doesn't appear that he was ever actually interviewed by investigators. And the most notable new information was that Deborah had a roommate. And it was Deborah's roommate who would provide the most critical information, not just for the Hackensack investigation, but for our investigation. It wasn't until November 14th of 2013 that the Hackensack PD were able to speak to Deborah's roommate, a 47-year-old man who we'll call Mr. F, who was living with Deborah when she disappeared. And this was well after Keyes had been implicated in her death, sort of confessed to murdering her, and then himself died by suicide. It was likely that the local news reporting on exactly that is what motivated Mr. F to voluntarily go to Hackensack PD and give a statement. Mr. F told investigators that he'd been living with Deborah for about 3 to 4 months when she disappeared in April of 2009. He said that she would frequently engage in sex work to support both herself and her drug use, and that, essentially, her phone would ring, she would leave the apartment to engage with a client, and then would return with cash. Unfortunately, Mr. F didn't know exactly how Deborah was advertising her sex work, and it's something we've looked into extensively. There's only one North New Jersey Craigslist casual encounter snapshot on the Wayback Machine within 6 months of Deborah's disappearance. It's from December of 2008, and because all of the actual posts included on it are now inactive, we can only see the post titles, which don't convey anything substantial or significant. There's nothing that strongly indicates it could be from Deborah Feldman. The closest back page snapshot we could find was from July of 2008, and it too didn't provide anything more than ambiguous post titles with inactive links. We were able to find an adult friend finder account that could have been Deborah's, but we've yet been able to confirm that it was actually hers. I combed through data breaches using every possible address, phone number, and email address I had for Deborah, and it came up with nothing significant. And then I combed through the archives of The Record, a North Jersey newspaper based out of Hackensack that included a fairly robust escorts and massage section in its classifieds. And this is where things got frustrating, because there are tons of ads on this paper, with phone numbers listed. But while we have possible phone numbers for Deborah, we've never been able to confirm that any of these were her actual phone numbers. And it's highly likely, considering her somewhat transient nature, that she changed her phone number fairly frequently. Based on what we know about Keyes, that he certainly used local newspapers and Craigslist, and possibly used Adult Friend Finder and Backpage, it seems likely that he came across Deborah by one of those means.
When did the whole prostitute thing come into play for you? Was that it, or did
had that was you... it? That was, yeah, no, Montreal.
So Montreal was before the military.
Yeah, well, that's the first time I'd gone was before, I think. Yeah.
Okay, you've been to Montreal a couple more than once then.
Yeah.
So was... Jump ahead now. Anchorage, visiting prostitutes, is that something that you've continued to do over the years, including in Anchorage?
Yeah, I mean, I've done it over the years. It's,
do you usually...
It's not something I do all the time.
Okay. Is it something when you... Is it something that you use the internet for? Is it something are you do you go out to the street? I know there's not a lot of streetwalkers anymore. At least up here there aren't. But,
yeah.
And they're...
Thanks to Craigslist.
Yep. Craigslist and Backpage and a few others. But is internet the way that you would usually find them? Or how would you...
No, that was, I mean, really, I've only used computers for the last few years.
Which websites did you use the most? You mentioned Craigslist, that's the most popular, I think.
Yeah. I would use the internet or phone books to get lists of phone numbers, and I would rate the phone numbers, and then I would when I got to whatever area that I was going to do it in, I just call down the list of numbers until I got a hit on one.
How would you rate it? What was the...
I would rate it just based on... the vibe I got off of the ad or the description online, and then, you know, usually only about 25% of the numbers work, so I'd write down, you know, a lot of different numbers. And,
so would you actually call and talk to somebody and see what they had to say, and that would be part of the rating, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind... the rating thing. Tell me if that's what this means.
You figured it out.
Does that look familiar?
Yeah.
Is that what that is? The 1-2-3 rating system?
Because
we know that those are numbers, and we know what those are numbers too, but okay. That makes sense, what you're talking about with the rating system then. Did you call any of these?
No. I don't think so.
Because this was from your trip.
It was in the car.
It was in the car, so it was on that when you were arrested.
Right. That wasn't a for sure thing. That was just one of those things. If I had had the opportunity to go up there, I would have gone. It's not like I was going to go for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably wasn't going to go because the whole, you know, there was a lot of bullshit going on with my family there at the time, so I didn't want to. I just wanted to get out of there and just kind of wasn't really thinking about any of that stuff, so.
And that leads us to what Mr. F told investigators next. Mr. F said that on the night of April 8th of 2009, at some point between 10 p.m. and 11:30 p.m., Deborah received a phone call. When she got off the phone, she told him she would see him later, and then left, which was akin to her behavior when responding to calls for sex work. Only this time, she never returned. And that brings us to Israel Keyes. Valentine's is coming up, and please allow me to play matchmaker for you, because you and Brooke Linen are made for each other. So feel the love this season with their line of bed and bath essentials that fill your home with life's little luxuries. And speaking of love, I love life's little luxuries, particularly Brooke Linen's award-winning Luxe Sateen sheets. But enough about me, and back to you and Brooke Linen. Brooklinen would never let anyone come between you, so they use their direct supplier relationship to source high-quality materials at fair pricing. And over 100,000 everyday experts have fallen head over heels for their 5-star home essentials. Because here's the thing, pleasure doesn't stop in the bedroom with Brooklinen. You can share the love with your bathroom by giving it a spa-at-home feel with luxury upgrades like their ultra-soft robes and towels. Create a space that you and everyone else will have a crush on with Brooklinen. Visit brooklinen.com to get $20 off plus free shipping on orders of $100 and more with code TCB. That's BROOKLINEN.com for $20 off plus free shipping on orders of $100 and more with code TCB.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When we last took an in-depth look at Keyes' April 2009 trip to the East Coast, there were some issues. For one, I got the location of the Tupper Lake bank robbery wrong. Secondly, we weren't sure which Southwest flight Keyes took from Seattle to Manchester, New Hampshire. Third, we've since gotten several tips identifying Deborah's actual last known location, after she left the apartment on the night of the 8th. And finally, and way more importantly, back then I struggled with reconciling Keyes' activities on that trip with the mileage that he put on his rental car. We've since determined that there were no direct flights between Seattle and Manchester on the day that Keyes flew, April 7th. Fortunately, the only connecting airport on that day for Southwest was Midway in Chicago. And the only flights that would have worked for Keyes would have been a 9:45 a.m. out of Seattle, arriving at Midway at 3:10 p.m. And from there, a 7:25 p.m. flight arriving in Manchester at 10:25 p.m. And this is important because it helps us with the mileage that Keyes put on his rental car on that trip, and with tightening up our timeline. Now we know that Keyes landed, picked up the rental car at the airport, then drove it directly to the Highlander Inn, which is directly across the street from the airport. So after arriving on April 7th, he didn't go anywhere except for the hotel, and he put less than a mile on his rental car. You may recall that when Keyes returned the rental car on April 14th, he'd racked up 1,047 miles. But based on what he told us about his activities that week, the places we can place him, and some reasonable assumptions made surrounding both, it would have been impossible for Keyes to abduct Deborah Feldman from her Hackensack apartment and do everything else he mentioned in less than 1,200 miles. But since that first deep dive, we've gotten multiple confirmations that Keyes did, in fact, kill Deborah Feldman. Some of these include Keyes telling the FBI during his October 22nd interview, after lying about Deborah for weeks, that he just doesn't want to talk about Deborah yet. Or the Essex PD notes that state that as of October 3rd, the FBI believe that Keyes has identified the New York victim as Deborah Feldman. Or further along in the Essex PD notes, where they cite an email from Frank Russo that reads, "He basically confirmed the New York, New Jersey victim when pressed. He initially denied it, and then conceded that he just didn't want to talk about her, but there's more to the story." And all this begs the question, how did Keyes do everything he said he did, with the mileage that he put on that rental car? Well, it turns out those tips about Deborah's last known whereabouts would prove critical in that. Sometime in 2013, the FBI traveled to the Sharp Building in Mahwah, New Jersey, I'm sure I pronounced that wrong, forgive me, to investigate the disappearance of Deborah Feldman. This at first came to us in the form of a listener tip, but was later confirmed by a source. The source couldn't confirm the impetus nor results of this trip, but according to the original tip, the FBI was there because it was Deborah's last known whereabouts on the night of April 8, 2009. They reportedly interviewed multiple people who worked in that building. The Sharp Building is a fairly isolated but pronounced building that straddles the New Jersey-New York state line. It houses office space and a Sheraton hotel. The building is at the junction of Highways 17 and 202, and Interstates 87 and 287. It sits directly across the interstate from a forested area, with a campground, a cemetery, and tribal lands. The Sharp Building is 18 miles along Route 17 from Deborah's apartment on Park Street in Hackensack. And while Deborah didn't have a car, it's fairly easy to get there from her apartment. Either a 20-minute cab ride or a 50-minute train ride. And while we don't have particulars, if this is where the FBI seemed to believe / know that Deborah was last seen, it's likely the area Keyes abducted her from, rather than her apartment. Which tracks? It's on a state line, at the junction of multiple highways. Interstate 87, by the way, essentially goes directly from Hackensack to both Burlington and Constable, and it's in a heavily wooded area near campgrounds and cemeteries. It's also a fairly significant distance from her home. And as Keyes said, he let his victims come to him. And it would reduce the mileage needed to commit the abduction by about 37. The timing here is also critical. The last ping on Keyes' known cell phone before he turned it off was at 6:53 p.m. on April 8th, when he received a text message. That ping hit on a Burlington, Vermont tower. He checked into a hotel in nearby Colchester earlier that afternoon. It takes about 5 hours to drive from the Burlington area to North New Jersey, where Hackensack and Mahwah are. If Keyes turned off his phone, then drove directly there, he'd arrive at about 11 p.m. Mr. F said that Deborah received the phone call at some time between 10 p.m. and 11:30 p.m. So while Keyes told the FBI that he only sought out sex workers for sex, it's abundantly clear through the Deborah Feldman files that, in at least her case, he contacted her via burner phone prior to her abduction. And this might explain his reluctance to talk about Deborah at all. He didn't want the FBI to know that he was targeting sex workers, nor that he was using phones and the internet to interact with his victims. The other place we can make up mileage is the Colchester Hotel. The assumption has long been that Keyes returned to the Burlington area at some point between abducting and burying Deborah, and then robbing the bank in Tupper Lake. But there's no actual proof that this ever happened. Keyes paid for the hotel, two nights, up front and in cash, on April 8th. But there's no proof or indication that he ever returned to the hotel following checking into it. We can't even prove that he spent a single night there, that he ever even stepped foot into the hotel room. Not returning would buy him about 3 hours and 190 miles. And this is something we've suspected Keyes of doing before. Twice he booked and paid for stays in Anchorage area hotels when the timeline places him in Washington State. There's also the fishing licenses he paid for that placed him in Alaska and Wyoming at the same time. He's essentially paying a very small price for a very good alibi. So if we remove any return to Colchester between Deborah and the bank robbery, and place Deborah's abduction in Mahwah rather than Hackensack, it brings Keyes' mileage down to 978 miles. 69 miles less than he put on that rental car. And that brings us to what we've learned about Tupper Lake.
Are the locals in New York involved at all? Were they involved in the search for the guns?
Only FBI was.
Was there any media coverage on that search?
No. That would look like a... if it's a pretty secluded place, may have even looked like a training
exercise. No, there was no media coverage.
Training exercise. If that... my understanding is they took one truck and four people out there.
There was no media.
There's nothing...
Nope.
Nobody knows.
Well... tell you what, we'll compromise a little bit. There was there's some other stuff in New York which is in a way related to Vermont. So if Vermont needs to hear something, that's what you can tell them. Those guns that I dug up in Burlington that I had buried there for a few years. That's where the guns ended up, but on that trip it was a New York thing.
A couple years earlier.
Yeah, I don't remember the year, but it was, yeah. So, we'll leave it at that, see what they do. But I'm not gonna start giving information nationwide until we see what happens back there.
Sure.
Because, I'm just not ready for that yet. I think it started out, I was going to just talk to one teller, but then when I saw there were only a few people there, I just took over the place. I didn't take over on the whole place.
Okay.
You said you used one of the guns that you had buried in Vermont?
I had both of them with me. Both of the ones that ended up buried in Vermont. I buried them in Vermont after the New York.
Was there one that you had out and one you had on your person?
Yeah.
Which one did you have out?
Actually, it would have been the same. I think the one I had out was the same one I used in the one in Texas that Smith & Wesson 40 caliber. And I think I had a 10/22 under my jacket.
Just one bank robbery that time?
Yeah.
In season one, I reported that the Tupper Lake bank robbery occurred in downtown Tupper Lake. And while that is the current location of Tupper Lake Community Bank, when Keyes robbed it, it was located at 314 Hosley Avenue, on the corner of Hosley and the now infamous New York Route 30. It's on the outskirts of Tupper Lake, adjacent to a school, and not far from the boat ramp I stumbled upon back in 2020. Speaking of, when we were able to get the audio from Keyes' final interview cleaned up, we got a lot of new information, including the alleged location of the New York victim.
On the Tupper Lake thing, you had agents up there with the cameras, but you just wanted to talk about the bank robbery, or were you...
Well, what we had set up was we just had them at the bank robbery parking lot to show you the live feed that we could do.
We can talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah. We didn't have any expectations, but we thought the natural progression, because of what we've been talking, would be in that general area, so we wanted to get things moving there.
Right.
You know, and if you wanted to just, like, pull out of the parking lot and then take us to the river bend, that would be all the better.
Well, I was just...
You would be driving.
Yeah, it would be like you'd be driving. So... because we thought maybe that's how it's going to have to be eventually, maybe, is that you might have to be in the driver's seat, so to speak, to see, you know, landmarks or whatever you need to see.
The River Bend. It's an area that comes up in the case files. They mention a possible burial site near an S-shaped bend in the Raquette River, about 2 miles outside of Tupper Lake. But this is the first time where we hear Key say it, and it's when I either realized or remembered, we've been at this for a long time, that boat ramp is 2 miles out of town, along an S-shaped bend in the river. As you may recall, the boat ramp area has a permanent outhouse, along with 2 parking areas separated by a wooded dirt road, and it's completely obscured from the highway. I have video footage of this area on the YouTube channel. But it was always the outhouse that interested me the most. We knew Keyes had his encounter in Deschutes in an outhouse. And he even admitted that he'd staked out that outhouse before. And that gives interesting context to Keyes' comments about the state of remains, and any possible searches that might take place for the New York victim.
But we thought the memory lane trip up Tupper Lake would be more interesting, maybe for both of us.
Yeah, well, I spent a lot of time in Tupper Lake, so. I'm sure we can find our way around.
So you're thinking next week?
Yeah, I don't have a specific date yet, but we'll work on setting up a date next week. And we'll do it like we did this time, early enough that if you've got other stuff...
Right.
Try not to make a conflict with that so that we can get you back there by mid-morning even.
Right. Yeah, I didn't realize you guys had went all out. You didn't mention that when you came in.
Yeah, I did mention that. You weren't receptive.
Well, look, that's all right. It's your decision, but we just want to let you know they're going to set it up next week, and it'll be your choice whether to come over or not, but they're probably not going to set keep. Yeah, they're only able to do this.
Well, we'll do it again.
Yeah. Gas is expensive. Keep it in within the budget. So.
Tupper Lake is probably still a good location now.
Yeah.
The remains, are they buried or are they in water or is it going to be retrievable eventually?
Yeah, good question.
Buried?
There should be something.
Okay.
It's going to be a search on scale with what they're having to do in Vermont, at least, if not more. But
it's also knowing.
Right. I realize that knowing is the first step, but, you know, the fact of the matter is that it's inevitable that they're going to want to find something. They're going to want, you know, they're going to want the bodies. They're going to want something. New York could turn into another... No, it won't be as bad as, like, what's going on in Vermont now. That's, you know, really public right now. That's what I'm concerned about. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't have any. I mean, you haven't given us anything on New York that anyone can do anything about. So,
right.
Which is good and bad, right? You know, it's good because you don't. We got nothing. You haven't given up anything, but it's bad because then we don't have anything to follow up on.
Well,
it's useful. I'm not, but you know, you got to know that the ups, the plus and minus is you've kept.
I know. I don't. I mean, I'm not going anywhere.
In several interviews between May and November of 2012, Keyes tells the FBI that A. he's been to Tupper Lake many times. B. the scale of the search for the New York victim will be on par with that of the Couriers, a search which involved teams of people going through the dump for months on end. And C. that the media won't be as big a problem with the New York victim. What I take from this is A. he spent a lot of time scouting out Tupper Lake. B. the New York victim isn't simply buried in the ground or in water. The recovery will require greater effort than a dig or a dive. And C. this victim isn't editorial. They're not one Keyes deems newsworthy. Not one that will get a lot of press attention. Like a sex worker. The Deborah Feldman files both tell us a lot and a little. They demand more questions than they answer. Did Keyes intercept Deborah before she entered the Sharp building? Was the Sheraton Hotel a rendezvous spot for Deborah? Or was it a place that Keyes told her to meet him? But the files also prove some long-held suspicions. Keyes was absolutely using phones and the internet to contact his victims. And Keyes was absolutely killing sex workers. And that proof? It opens up two very broad avenues of investigation. One, missing sex workers. And two, victims and potential victims who were using specific websites that Keyes was using. For example, just hours before he went missing, Jimmy Tidwell posted his washer for sale on Craigslist. Bill Courier also used some of the websites Keyes did. Susie Lyle had a very active online life. Marble Arvidsson had a very active online life. And those are just to name a few. The Feldman files also tell us a little and a lot about Deborah, and how her disappearance was handled. 10 paragraphs says so little, but so, so much. And even in everything they didn't do or say or look into, we can still glean enough to see that Deborah's life had value. She had friends. She had people who cared about her. Someone in her life knew something was wrong after less than 2 days. She had a cat that she cared for, cared about. She lived a life, one that, for reasons still unknown, changed drastically. She was forced to make tough choices in order to survive. And those tough choices were used to minimize her death. The cycles of addiction and sex work and violence against sex workers and police apathy are all connected. They're systemic. In my research into missing sex workers, I read case after case of women who came upon some uncontrollable circumstance that forced them into drugs or sex work. I read story after story of women trying desperately to get out of the cycle, to reclaim their lives, only to fall victim to it again, and then victim to something worse. Teresa Maxwell, for example, was a former addict and sex worker. She got her life back on track, and then she got cancer. and when she couldn't afford her cancer treatments, she turned back to sex work so she could literally afford to survive. Then she disappeared and was treated like, well, a missing sex worker. She wasn't editorial enough to write about or valuable enough to investigate. The system that put her in the position to turn to sex work is the same system that turned its back on her when sex work likely killed her. To say that Deborah was just a drug-addled woman farming out her body for more drugs is at best an oversimplification, and at worst negates everything that came before the drugs and sex work, and everyone who loved her in spite of it. Deborah was in debt when she vanished. She'd recently filed for bankruptcy. She was struggling to stay afloat. She was a friend, a mother, a person doing what she could from day to day to pay the bills and feed an addiction that no one ever asks for. In a statement at his trial, Gary Ridgway said this about sex workers: "I picked prostitutes as victims because they were easy to pick up without being noticed. I knew they would not be reported missing right away and might never be reported missing. I picked prostitutes because I thought I could kill as many of them as I wanted without getting caught." And he's right. Apathy around violence against sex workers enables more violence against sex workers. And when we focus on how marginalized people put themselves at a higher risk for violence, we ignore how that risk came to be and how we all contribute to it.
I keep going round and round on the same old circuit. A wire travels underground to a vacant lot, where something I can't see interrupts the current and shrinks the picture down to a tiny dot. And from behind the screen it can look so perfect, but it's not. So here I'm sitting in my car at the same old stoplight. I keep waiting for a change, but I don't know what. So red turns into green, turning into yellow, but I'm just frozen here on the same old spot. And all I have to do is to press the
This episode was written, researched, edited, and produced by me, your host, Josh Hallmark, with research assistance by Ben Lamb, Michelle Tooker, Shayna Walensky, and Kaz. Resources included NJ.com, the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, NamUs, the Charlie Project, and the New York Times. This episode was made possible by the following Patreon producers: Alexa Horn, Amy Basil, Annette, Benjamin Chapa Fong, Casey Jensen Richardson, Dana Keith, Dr. Jill Cooper, Drew Vipond, Hallie Reed, Jessica Alahodzik, Jillian Natale, John O'Leary, Kendall C., Kimberly K., Lauren F., Lindsay Curtis, Lindley Tuskoff, Manolis Bulikus, Megan Cap-Sewell, Mike Sherman, Nicole and Dennis Henry, Sarah C., S.C., Shannon Foster, Shelley Brewer, Tuesday Woodworth, Zach Ignatowitz-Warren, and Lydia Fiedler. Thank you to True Crime Bullshit's newest Patreon supporters. Melanie H., Robert C., Elizabeth D., Daniel V., Luke L., Cameron R.C., Jennifer B., Sarah L., Quinlan, Manuel A., Trisha M., Jillian B., and Lady Shade. To support the investigation, go to patreon.com/truecrimebs. This episode included music by William Hellfire, Radical Face, Lee Rosevere, Sergei Cheremisinov, Wythe, and Dan Mayo, with featured music by Amy Mann.
Well, people are tricky, you can't afford to show anything risky. So baby, kiss me like a drug, like a respirator, and let me fall into the dream of the astronaut, where I get lost in space.